You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, my beautiful people. I am glad you're with me today. We got back from New Orleans visiting the Mimi and some of my favorite people down there. Met up with my buddy Dalbar for dinner, he and his gal. A little foursome at the restaurant called Luke. It was excellent. And then we went out and met a few of my friends from the small town where I'm from afterward, and we had a ball. It was great to see everybody. So I'm back in Houston now, and what I'll try to do today, I figured we'd pick up where I left off last episode with Morgan Housel's The Art of Spending Money, and I'll probably weave in a story or two, as I tend to do. That way I figure I can try to cover all three of what my British friend says in the intro music, that we aim to entertain, educate, or elevate. And I'm thinking the book excerpts will cover the education part, and I'll try to entertain with examples of my own. And whether it elevates your life or not, that'll be up to you. Well, me too, actually. If we can all apply what we're learning here, all the better. I'm in the chapter called May I Have Your Attention, Please? Page 24, he quotes Dutch political philosopher Jan Willem Vanderwijk, who said the following. He said, "The appetite for applause counts amongst the lowest of human character traits." Next page, he shares something Warren Buffett said, which he prefaces with the following. He says, Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in history, who could literally buy anything he wanted, once said, "When you get to my age, you'll really measure your success in life by how many of the people you want to have love you actually do love you." Yeah, that makes sense, right? You can't buy $1 million worth of love. Charlie Sheen tried that with the goddesses. Got him AIDS, or HIV, rather. Except I don't think he got it from the goddesses. Remember he had porn stars who lived with him? I think he probably got it doing butt stuff with dudes, he's admitted. So drugs are bad. The best Charlie Sheen story I've ever heard, he was talking to Jim Rome. You remember the sports guy? I think he's still around. I don't listen to him anymore. But Jim Rome, R-O-M-E, not the self-development guru, which he spells his name R-O-H-N. But the sports interviewer, the guy who called Jim Everett Chris, remember? He threw the table and attacked him. So Charlie Sheen was talking to Jim Rome, and he was asked, "What's something cool that you've done with your money just because you could?" Which is a great question for somebody like Charlie Sheen, right? And maybe it informed his later decision to try live-in porn stars, right? Hey, what if I spent a bunch of money and did this? Isn't it interesting we refer to them as stars? Why do we do that? Is that because prostitute who opts not to keep it private is that's too long a description? How is prostitution illegal, but if you film it, it's totally legal? It's legit. How does that make any sense? Anyway, Charlie Sheen's answer was this. He said, for a game in Anaheim one time, he bought, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know exactly what he said, I'm going from memory. He said he bought $50,000 worth of tickets in left field so that it'd guarantee him a home run ball if one were hit. He said he didn't want to have to be crawling over the public because that's what leads to violence. So he's sitting there with a buddy by himself in left field, and Rome asked him, "Well, did you get a home run ball?" And he said, "No, we were too fucked up to get up and go get it." How about that? The next chapter is called The Happiest People I Know. Housel writes, "I've met half a dozen billionaires in my life. Not a single one was as happy as my grandmother-in-law. It was so easy to see why. Her low expectations gave her a sense of contentment, which in turn became an enormous source of psychological wealth that some of the richest people in the world lack. Contentment is what you have relative to what you want." So last week, I mentioned visiting my childhood bestie, Brett, and he lives in a small town with his wife, Ashley, and they're great people, and I really enjoy visiting them. I try to make it an annual thing now. Do people still name their kid Ashley? I know in 1991, Ashley and Brittany were the most popular names given to little girls. I knew a dude named Ashley. But I don't know. People name their kid. If you're in the UK, I think the most popular name for a baby now is Mohammed. But I've known almost as many Ashleys as I have Matts. And in fact, I know so many Ashleys and Matts that I've had two buddies that I graduated from high school who are already no longer with us. Both of them Matthews. My boy Spanky, Matt Vilvin, who left us in 08, and Matt Blankenship, who died more recently. Funny story about them. We had chemistry in the community together. ChemCom, they called it, or basically chemistry for dummies. And this was our junior year of high school. And they put the three of us at the same table. Why they would do that, I don't know. But it could be. I've never thought about this before. Our teacher was an Ellen DeGeneres clone. She was just the happiest, coolest lesbian lady you could have for a teacher, which is probably a good thing that she was a lesbian, right? Because that she wasn't into dudes, because it kept us from wanting to join the ranks of 16-year-olds across America who are raped by our teacher. So who knows what an Ellen clone is like outside the classroom, though, right? From what I understand, all who worked for Ellen were like, see you next Tuesday, butch, because she was so mean and awful to them. But anyway, so her Miss Step was our teacher's name. She put us up by the projector, and she would teach from the front of the class every day, and she was so cool. You know, just thinking back, I mean, she might have put us up there just so we could laugh all class. I don't know. But we enjoyed it so much, and I remember my buddies, Matt, both of them, they always smelled like cigarettes, and they'd have a big old chaw in their lip. A lot of my high school buddies dipped, and they would do it in class. They would do it all day. And they had this incredible ability to just spit once or twice the whole period, the whole hour of class. And you obviously can't carry a spit cup with you in high school. So they would just spit into the floor, because most of our classrooms were carpeted. And so you'd walk in and you'd see these big old brown stains on the carpet, and the teachers, they never caught on to it. You might think that's gross, but swallowing it is probably grosser, more gross. If grosser ain't a word, I don't know. Like ain't a word. You pick up what I'm spitting. Anyway, so I bring up my childhood bestie because my man cooked up the best shrimp fettuccine I've ever had. And they have a real nice house in Louisiana that they've probably lived in for, I don't know, 15 years or so, if I had to guess. And I asked them if they had ever considered moving. And the reason I wanted to ask is because I love how people, like Brett's parents, for example, they live in the same house that I rode my bike to when I was 10. So they buy a house in a small town, they stay there forever. Whereas in Houston, where I live, when I was in real estate full time, people moved on average every 4 to 5 years. And it was usually just to upgrade. And it's the same with vehicles. Hardly anybody goes down in vehicle where I live. And with houses, they generally want to live in a nicer, more prestigious neighborhood, or move where there are better schools for their kids or whatever. So I asked them, had they ever considered moving? And they both said no. And his wife said, we did think about it once. They were considering moving to another small town that's a few hours away. But even that would have been sort of a lateral move. That's my words, not hers. Because the town is just, she said this, that the town was just like the one they live in now. It's like a small, mostly Catholic community. So they're staying put. There's a line on page 29 where Housel writes, contentment is what you have relative to what you want. And in the next paragraph, he says, the person who has everything but wants even more feels poorer than the person who has little but wants nothing else. How could it be any different? Next page, he writes, there's a Stoic saying, not needing wealth is more valuable than wealth itself. Which kind of sounds like my favorite fun question. Is not wanting something just as good as having it? Page 35, when you're content, you're no longer chasing, which is a prerequisite to being in the moment. You only get to live in the moment, enjoying what you have right now, rather than dwelling on the past or dreaming about the future, when you have a complete absence of expectations that things would or could have been better than they are now. Then you get to enjoy what you have, what you're doing, what you've created, and who you're with. Title of the next chapter is Everything You Don't See. And the subtitle is, happiness depends on so much more than income. There are 13 divorces among the 10 richest men in the world. A few pages into the chapter, he writes, J. Paul Getty was once the richest man in the world, one of the first people to accumulate more than $1 billion. In a 1963 documentary, Getty was interviewed at his 700-acre, 72-room Sutton Place Castle, one of the most ornate and over-the-top homes to ever exist. And Getty is asked, what's it like to live like a modern king? His answers are mostly shrugs, it becomes clear that for all the money in the world, this is not a man bubbling with joy. Finally, he's asked, "Who do you envy?" And here's what he said. "I envy people younger and stronger and more cheerful than I am, people who have better characters than I have. I always wished that I had a better personality, that I could entertain people better. I always worried I might be on a little on the dull side." That's something about happiness that most people don't think about, that it only matters how someone feels about their circumstances, which is something you can't know. You could ask them, but a lot of people will lie to you because they want you to think they're happy, often thinking that it'd be a bad look if they had all this money and they weren't happy. So for this J. Paul Getty fella, one thing I would say is he didn't lack for integrity, which is probably, that probably played a large part in how he became so wealthy. He's honest. In this chapter, he also talks about Will Smith, who Will Smith said when he was poor and depressed, at least he could dream about a future where he had more money and using that money to make his problems go away. Once he was rich, that optimism was gone. He had all the money he could ever need and was still depressed. He still had problems. Music exec Rick Rubin once echoed something similar, saying, "It's hard to get really depressed until your dreams come true. Because once your dreams come true, you realize you feel the same way you did before. Then you feel hopeless." He said, "We mistakenly think outward success is going to change something in us, and it doesn't. The hole in ourselves that we're hoping to fill with success doesn't get filled." So again, yeah, what's crucial is how you feel about your life, about your circumstances. If you don't think how you feel is important, ask any woman in your life. They'll probably tell you how you feel is everything. And I don't know that they'd be wrong. I'm way more in tune to how I feel following my Ibogaine experience. I had no clue the range of emotions the body was capable of feeling before I went through this, the worst withdrawal there is. It's unimaginably terrible. I don't think I've shared this opinion on the pod before, but I'm now convinced maybe half of all suicides are somebody, they're going through withdrawal. I believe it's now believed pretty widely that Hitler was going through withdrawal after that book that Norman Ohler wrote called Blitzed, because Germany had been decimated and his doctor couldn't find a pharmacy to get the drugs that he was given to Hitler. Because, yeah, it's that bad. And I said on the episode with Justin that when I was going through the worst of it, I would have jumped off a 6-story building to get the drug. That's jumping off 6 stories, that's pretty much certain death, right? Depending on the surface below, and I guess how high the ceilings are on each floor, but just giving you an idea of how desperate you become. And the hardest part is nobody's holding a gun to your head saying, "No, you have to stay here." I would also say if you wanted to torture somebody, I've been to former torture dungeons in different parts of the world, like the Museum of Terror in Budapest has one. I've been to Auschwitz and some other concentration camps. I've seen where and how they've put people through hell and throughout history. Like I remember at Auschwitz, there was this maybe like a 6x4 rectangular area that you stand. It was bricked, and so you get in it, and it's up to your chest, and they would pack as many people into that little square as they could and starve them to death. I think I was at Auschwitz when I saw that. I think that's where it was. But I'm going to say that the worst torture you could put someone through, well, let me say this. If you wanted to coerce information out of someone, like a narco-terrorist, you'd give him a taste of his own medicine, literally. The precursors coming from China through the Mexican border, or if they're coming over the Caribbean, I don't know. I think they've had to find alternate routes to deliver the killer combos that they're, the fentanyl they're sending through. Yeah, if you wanted to get information from somebody, you'd give that motherfucker fentanyl and you'd remove it and let him go through withdrawal. And I would bet everything I have, they'd be singing before the sun came up. And I don't care who it is or how tough you are. If I had a chance to meet President Trump tomorrow, I'd tell him those narcos delivering fentanyl to the U.S., killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, give them a taste of their own medicine. Inject the first few with fentanyl and let them lead you to all the other narcos, and that'll put an end to all this bullshit real quick. Then we'd only have to worry about the communists who make TikTok videos supporting the fentanyl dealers, right? I was hanging out with a lib last week, just to give you a peek inside the mind of your modern communist. She would ask me questions and not listen to the answer. So she'd say, were there a lot of people at the concert? And I would start to answer, and she'd already be talking about something else. So when it happened a second time, I said, why do you ask questions if you don't want to know my answer? And you know what she said? Why can't you just be nice to me? What? You see how that works? It's a very common mode of behavior where someone is an a-hole to you or treats you like shit, whatever, and you call them out for it, and then they think you're the a-hole for acknowledging their assholery. It's wild, but it's all too common nowadays. All right, let's get back to the book. Page 42, the late psychologist Daniel Kahneman, he's the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, I would add. He once said, nothing in life is as important as you think it is when you are thinking about it. He pointed out that paraplegics are often unhappy, but they are not unhappy all the time because they spend most of their time experiencing and thinking about things other than their disability. One more reason to, at least to whatever extent possible, that you can learn to control your thoughts. I can help. Want coaching? Let me know. Next chapter. The most valuable financial asset is not needing to impress anyone. And the subtitle is the ability to not need to prove yourself to strangers is priceless. He says there are only two benchmarks to measure yourself against to determine how well you're doing in life, internal and external. The first, how you are with yourself. The other is what other people think of you. It's astounding to watch how agonizing it can be when someone focuses too much on their external benchmark. And it's so thrilling to witness someone whose only goal in life is to nail their internal benchmarks. Agree. And I would add, compete with yourself, nobody else. And go to work on yourself so the person you're competing with the rest of your life is a worthy competitor. He poses the question later in the chapter, are you spending money on something because it makes people think differently of you, like you more, be more impressed with you, maybe even jealous of you, or because it actually feeds your soul and makes you happy? What's that age-old question about being the world's greatest lover? Would you rather be known as the world's greatest lover and not be any good in bed? Or would you rather be a stallion in the sack but have a reputation as being a fish out of water? Or that means dead, right? A dead-smelling fish. I think that's how it goes. Well, Hauzo is saying that he doesn't know the balance between the internal and external benchmarks, but he knows that there's a strong social pull to live up to these external benchmarks that we've dreamed up for ourselves, stupidly, I might add. But he also says he knows that there's a strong natural desire for internal measures, being independent, following your quirky habits, and doing what you want, when you want, with whom you want. He adds, that's money's highest purpose because that's what most people actually want. That's what I want, which is, that's my little girl and I's favorite song, that Morgan Wallen, That's What I Want song. Next chapter, what makes you happy? He writes, page 67, when you're content with what you have now, an occasional treat or surprise can feel incredible. You appreciate and savor it more. And he gives examples, a surprise dinner, a rare splurge, a hotel room upgrade. Yeah, that's what I like. I'm after that view. I want that view, baby. He says, when you live a simple and modest life, your occasional experience with nice things can generate more joy than if you had those things all the time. A few pages on, he says, I don't want to live a life of destitution, deprived of all luxury, but I have an even stronger desire to experience the joy that contrast delivers when I experience an occasional luxury, or a nice surprise, or an unexpected treat. I don't think I've shared this story on the pod. When we were in Costa Rica in October, we were staying on the 10th floor of a high-rise building, and I fell asleep on the couch one night, which doesn't happen often, especially before 10 p.m. But on this night I did, and I was out cold. I was out like a thief in the night, sinking my teeth in the bite. I was sleeping so good. And the wife comes in all frantic and says, there was just a big earthquake. The whole building was swaying back and forth. I thought we were all going to die. And remember, I was sleeping. And I thought, surely if there was a big earthquake, it would have woken me up. Because the last time I was in Costa Rica during an earthquake, I was sleeping and all of a sudden my bed felt like a waterbed. And there was no ignoring it. It woke everybody up. My buddy Dan was there and in this condo where we were staying, and he was thrown from the couch. Anyway, I looked at my wife and I said, "Are you sure you weren't dreaming?" What an a-hole, right? We were watching The Perfect Neighbor last night. Has anybody seen that show on? It's like a documentary. I think it's an hour and a half long, where that old white lady shot that neighbor of hers through the door. Was that not terrible? What was amazing to me about that show was that it was all done from body cams and a camera inside the interrogation room, which they always have. But they made an entire Netflix show from body cams, which is ironic, right? Because they had the push to defund the police. What would fuel the funding of police precincts or whoever gets the money than just selling the body cam footage to Netflix and people like me watch it all over the country, all over the world? All right, let's get into the chapter called The Rich and the Wealthy, where he talks about the Vanderbilts, the Commodore. They called Cornelius Vanderbilt the Commodore. He died in 1877. Adjusted for inflation, he left his heirs about $300 billion, with a B. He is said to have had more money than the U.S. Treasury did at the time. But within 60 years, there was almost nothing left. Reggie Vanderbilt was one of the last heirs to inherit significant wealth. About $350 million with an M. Again, adjusted for inflation. He was just 21 years old, and he blew it all. The family biographer, he wrote on page 77, "Self-indulgent, lazy, lackadaisical. Reggie had absolutely no sense of responsibility or purpose other than to keep himself from being bored. He was never employed and never did a lick of work. Somewhat at a loss when asked his occupation, he usually responded, 'Gentleman.' The only way Reggie could distinguish himself was to live the life of a rich playboy, and this he did with dedication and consummate skill. Reggie's two great loves were liquor and gambling. The first left him dead at age 45. With cirrhosis so severe, the blood flow from his liver was choked off and pushed up to his esophagus, where veins abruptly ruptured and left him choking in a pool of blood as his family watched in horror." On the next page, he tells the story of Harvey Firestone, the late tire tycoon. He wrote in his 1926 memoir, he said, "Why is it that a man, just as soon as he gets enough money, builds a house much bigger than he needs? He said, the houses are only a burden. I don't know why I do it." He had a mansion in Akron, another in Miami Beach, and he said, "I don't know why I do it, but I have done it, and all my friends who have acquired wealth have big houses." Oh, I should mention, Reggie Vanderbilt was the grandfather of Anderson Cooper, the CNN anchor. Housel writes, "He was one of the first Vanderbilts not to be promised dynastic wealth, which may have been a blessing. He's not only the most successful Vanderbilt heir in over 100 years, but appears to be the happiest." Anderson Cooper once said, "I think an inheritance is an initiative sucker. I think it's a curse. From the time I was growing up, if I felt there was some pot of gold waiting for me, I don't know if I would have been so motivated." Page 90, this one hits close to home. Let's see here. Author David Brooks once wrote about a trip to Africa. He and his family stayed in seven different locations, some modern and luxurious, others camp style with no running water. After the trip, Brooks and his family realized they enjoyed their lower-end homely camps more than the nice hotels. At the cheap camps, they got to socialize with locals and meet other guests. His kids played soccer with the staff. At the expensive hotels, they were isolated in cocoons of sterile safety. That was the entire allure of the nice hotels. Stay here and you'll hardly notice. any difference between Midtown Manhattan and the Serengeti. Yeah, I've been to a safari in Africa, and there are so many different levels. You can do it pretty cheaply for maybe $200 a night. This is 10 years ago, but it goes all the way up to thousands per night. Next chapter, Risk and Regret. He has a quote here from actor David Cassidy. He says his last words were, "So much wasted time. What a terrible thing to realize when it's too late. And I wonder if it'll become more common as many of us spend our days aimlessly scrolling our social media." Daniel Kahneman once said an important part of becoming good with money was having a well-calibrated sense of your future regret. You need to accurately understand how you'll feel about your current decisions at various points in the future. Yeah, that reminds me of Jeff Bezos's regret minimization framework. A few pages later, he says, taking too little risk, he's quoting author Nick Maggiulli. It says, taking too little risk is like smoking cigarettes. Taking too much risk is like doing heroin. Both will harm you. The only difference is how quickly. Page 99. That I just read to you from page 99. Page 104 might be my favorite quote in the book. He says, everyone's different, which is why the blanket advice, this isn't my favorite quote, but I'll get to it. It's on the same page. Everybody's different, which is why the blanket advice of live for today or invest for tomorrow can miss so much real-world nuance. The only good advice is to minimize your future regrets. So then down below it says, good memories are the closest thing to living for today while compounding for tomorrow. He says, the anonymous Twitter account FedSpeak once wrote, the purpose of life is to experience things for which you will later experience nostalgia. I love that quote. In fact, I've written it in the little inscription when I've given this book away a few times. I can't be alone in realizing that as I get older, memories of things that took place 10, 20, 30 years ago are some of my most cherished memories. They aren't financial assets, but boy, they are very real assets nonetheless. That's what Housel said. There's a chapter called Look at Them. That's interesting. It deals with comparing yourself to others. And probably what I liked most from this chapter was author C.S. Lewis. He talks about wants to find this feeling so well, talking about the feeling of comparing yourself. He calls it the inner ring. Life, he described, is often viewed as a series of social rings, and people's desire is to break into the next level, the more exclusive ring. If you're outside of a ring, nothing seems better than the thought of being on the inside. But once you're on the inside of one ring, you realize you're not nearly as happy as you thought you'd be, and you shift your attention to the next ring where nirvana seems to reside. So much of life is like that, a constant struggle of viewing other people as having something we want, and then once you have that thing, you spot yet another person who has something new that you want, and around you go, ever disappointed. Lewis wrote, unless you take measures to prevent it, this desire is going to be one of the chief motives of your life, from the first day on which you enter your profession until the day when you are too old to care. How about that? Oh, and he said he wrote that 80 years ago, and it's so much worse today. J.P. Morgan's observation that watching your neighbor become rich undermines your financial judgment was true when he said it more than a century ago. Today, everyone is effectively your neighbor, where social media turns envy and comparison into an Olympic sport. He goes on to say it's nearly impossible to win the status game. He talks about how Kevin Kelly said, if you want to know what lower income groups are going to aspire to, how they aspire to spend their money in the future, what you want to do is look at higher income groups and see what they do today. And he gave the example of European vacations and how they were once the exclusive playground of the rich, and then they trickled down. And it's the same with college, and which was once reserved for the highest income groups, and then it spread. And it's the same with investing. He said in 1921, the peak of the Roaring Twenties bubble, 5% of Americans owned stocks, and virtually all of them were very wealthy. Well, today it's 58% of households own stocks in some form. The European vacation thing is interesting because, as you know, we spent the summer in Europe, and we were watching National Lampoon's European Vacation the other day, and I can remember when I was a kid thinking how exotic and far away Europe was. And so now that people do it regularly, like myself, yeah, you have a different view of it. We kind of all have access. What makes something high status is the fact that others don't have it. Once they eventually get their hands on that thing, it no longer is considered high status. And they pointed out the play Hamilton, and how he talks about Rob Henderson, that he noticed as a student at Yale that his classmates loved the Broadway play Hamilton, but once it was released on Disney's streaming platform and available to everybody, they started to hate it. All right, let's check in on the best movie ever. There's actually not a lot going on, other than my belief being further reinforced that we're watching a great movie. It does seem that way to you, right? Watching the way that our U.S. military forces have surrounded Venezuela and seized an oil tanker. We got to see a video of that siege. When has that ever happened before? Never, to the best of my knowledge. So, great movie. Trump has said Maduro's days are numbered. The president of Venezuela. There's a post by Awakened Outlaw. He said, the left went and effed the whole world up. The right, who just wanted to be left alone, are now forced into undertaking painful corrective measures to save civilization, which in turn made the left mad as shit. You are here. You might find this interesting. Only 17% of time spent on Facebook is spent viewing content posted by friends. On Instagram, it's only 7% on Instagram. Here are a couple of posts by Rob Henderson. He's always a great follow on X. 40% of 18 to 29-year-olds say violence against the rich can be justified. How about that? 2 out of 5? This shows up not only in attitudes toward political violence, but in views about shoplifting, fare evasion, betrayal, interpersonal aggression, and even domestic or child abuse. By the way, he says this pattern holds true even after controlling for education, income, and political orientation. Another post of his, he says, increased exposure to poor individuals is associated with lower support for redistribution of wealth among wealthy individuals. Local exposure to poor individuals reduces support for redistribution among the well-off. Yeah, I know that to be true from my experience, too. When you spend time with poor people around the world, a lot of people expected me to come back some dim-witted leftist, but surprise, it's not me. Hunter Ash posted this. He was summarizing a study that was done on the effects of universal basic income, and rightfully came to the conclusion that poverty doesn't cause crime. He says, rather, the same underlying traits, low intelligence and low self-control, cause both poverty and crime, which is something your average leftist doesn't believe, right? You presumably, because a communist isn't going to touch the idea that someone might be more talented than someone else, or that some individuals are just smarter than others, more brain power. I saw where the average Somali IQ is somewhere around 68. Did you know that in the United States military, you can't serve if you don't have about an 85 IQ or higher? And I say about because the aptitude test they give isn't an IQ test per se, but it's something that allows them to approximate your IQ, I guess. But they use something called an AFQT test, not IQ. Since there's not a lot going on in the movies, let's talk investing. I've got a post from The Idea Farm on the Substack I want to talk you through. It's really good. It's mostly investing quotes. Some are personal finance. It says 25% of the U.S. adult population have a FICO score below 660. So a quarter of all adults have a FICO score, that's a credit score, below 660. Currently, about 15% of 26-year-olds are uninsured. That's health insurance. The highest rate of any age group. Nearly 10 million American children are living in poverty, the most since 2018, according to the latest Census Bureau figures from 2023. In 1960, spending on housing, healthcare, and tuition made up 22% of consumer spending for the average U.S. household. Today, those spending categories make up 37%. That's housing, healthcare, and tuition. Let's see. Of the largest 10 stocks in the S&P 500 index in 1985. So top 10 stocks, largest stocks in the S&P in 85. None of them are still in the top 10. Just 3% of companies generated all shareholder wealth in the U.S. stock market from 1926 to 2022. How about that? All right, these I think are more interesting. There are more private equity funds than McDonald's restaurants in the world. Nearly half of all gold production is used for jewelry. 39% of U.S. land area is used by farms, totaling 876 million acres of farmland. How about that? Almost 40% of U.S. land area is used by farms. I had no idea. In 2021 alone, 478, or 30, about 30% of all U.S. unicorns hit the $1 billion mark. Apple has bought back $709 billion in stock over the past 10 years, which is greater than the market cap of 487 companies in the S&P 500. In fiscal year 2025, Costco sold over 245 million hot dog combos, over 157 million rotisserie chickens, and enough bath tissue to reach the moon and back over 200 times. Only 16.1% of consumers opening either Uber or Lyft also opened the other. Yeah, I've never used Lyft in my life. TiVo ended sales of its physical video devices on October 1st, 2025. In the quarter from April to June, I guess that'd be Q2 to you and me, American Express wrote a check to Delta Airlines for roughly $2.1 billion, equivalent to the airline's total operating profit. Walmart, Kroger, Aldi, and Albertsons own a third of all U.S. grocery store locations. Canada does not hold any gold in its official reserves. There are more robots working in China than the rest of the world combined. The U.S. spends more on healthcare per capita than other nations. Yeah, that's obvious, right? More than 60% of single-family houses in the United States were built more than 35 years ago. Wow, the equivalent of about $1,800 per person in America will be invested in AI this year. There are about 5,426 data centers in the U.S., and in Germany, there are 529. Wow, Germany has about 10% of the amount of data centers that we do. Oh, this is interesting with regards to socioeconomics. 12th grade girls are less likely than boys to say they want to get married someday. That is incredible. One in five American adults is illiterate. 54% of adults read below a sixth grade level, as anyone on Facebook can attest. Let's see. Miscellaneous U.S. pedestrian deaths have risen 80% since 2009. That's people using their text neck, I imagine, which is a syndrome, I believe. I had a doctor mention it to me the other day. He was worried I had text neck because I got a bad neck. Yeah, that's not my problem, bro. I take it to eye level every time. A majority of people in the U.S. wrongly believe that nicotine is the substance in cigarettes that causes cancer. It is not nicotine. It is tobacco. Cigarette filters are the single most littered item on the planet. All right, that's all I got for you today. I appreciate you tuning in. I'll chat back at you next time. Please copy the link and share it with a friend if you enjoyed, and God bless y'all.